Coming up on Tech News Weekly, it's me and Micah Sargent. We talk all about the big takeaways from yesterday's antitrust hearing in Washington, D.C. Also, China has ideas for a new internet called New IP. The amazing things that OpenAI's GPT-3 is enabling, and running macOS 8.1 as an app on your computer is possible, and we talk about it next on Tech News Weekly. Tech News Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. You're focused on security, but are your employees? LastPass can ensure that they are by making access and authentication seamless, whether they're working in the office or remote. Visit LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 144, recorded Thursday, July 30th, 2020. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Monday.com. Monday.com is a flexible platform to manage any team, project, or workflow online. Collaborate, plan, and track everything your team is working on wherever you are. To start your free 14-day trial, go to Monday.com/twit.
And by Salesforce Service Cloud. Salesforce Service Cloud is the world's number one customer service platform that empowers organizations to deliver service from anywhere, from home, in the office, or in the field. Go to bit.ly/Salesforce for service to find out more.
And by ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple and smart. That place is ZipRecruiter, where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. Try it for free at ziprecruiter.com/TNW.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Micah Sargent.
I'm Jason Howell, and this show is made for this week, or yesterday rather. Everybody yesterday was abuzz about this hearing. We got some stuff to talk about today, Micah.
Absolutely, we do. Yeah. Of course, you may have heard about the antitrust hearing, and if you didn't, I'm impressed, honestly. Some of the biggest tech companies in not just the United States, but in the world gathered together for a video conference, which we all are getting used to for sure, to talk about antitrust at the corporate technology level. And, you know, inevitably there were conversations about tech support and not being able to find links in YouTube and messages going to spam and all those kinds of things that
muted.
Often happen.
No, not you, Micah. No. That was another thing that came up, right? Like, we're so used to doing this in our work from home world. That even happened at the hearings. Sorry, didn't mean to confuse you.
That's okay. See, that's what happens in these things. But I thought that it would be great to have a conversation that kind of got outside of what the... I hate to call it the media, but a large swath of media seemed to focus on. And the senior writer for 1-0 at Medium, Will Oremus, is here to talk about that. Welcome, Will.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Micah.
Yeah, happy to have you here. So I saw your article, and I thought that it touched on a really good point, because I think I can remember the last time that there was a conversation at this level, and it was with Facebook independently. And they talked to Mark Zuckerberg, and the conversation inevitably surrounded a conversation about online speech. It was about how Facebook was or was not censoring speech. And as is the case kind of leading up to this, and then during the actual conversation, there was a lot of talk about that as well. But you put out an article talking about something that needed to be paid attention to that was not that free speech argument so much, but was about a bigger concern. So do you want to give kind of your basic premise as we get into this a little bit more?
Yeah. So I think that there's been so much discourse about how social media has influenced our information ecosystem, our democracy, the way we talk to each other and relate to each other, that you know, people said, well, we need to break up big tech and maybe that'll help with some of these problems. But that wasn't really what this hearing was about. This hearing, you might not have known it as a casual viewer, but it was the sixth in a series of hearings that's been going on for over a year by this subcommittee. And what they're investigating is digital platforms and market power. So I think people jumped to the assumption that somehow Congress was trying to use antitrust as a tool to fix the problems we all hear about all the time with Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and online speech, hate speech, disinformation, foreign election interference. That really wasn't what this was about, or at least not what it was supposed to be about. There is some connection there, so I don't want to entirely dismiss it, because it is the size of a platform like Facebook that makes its decisions on content moderation so important. But there are really completely different issues, especially when you forget about Facebook for a second and think about the other three companies involved. Amazon, Apple, and Google, they run these platforms that they control, and the platforms have spawned economies of their own. So Apple has spawned an app economy on iOS. Google has helped to create the economy of the web and the economy of links and online advertising. And Amazon has created this economy of online retail, and it hosts all these third-party sellers and is a clearinghouse for their products. And the issue, one of the core issues in the antitrust inquiry into these companies, is that not only do they own these platforms and control the economies, but they're also increasingly players in those economies. They see third-party sellers or websites or apps making a lot of money on their platform, and they think, hey, we could do that. And the problem there is that they have privileged information. They have a godlike view of what's going on these platforms. And so if they decide to intervene, if they decide to jump in, Apple says, hey, look at Spotify. They're doing great on iOS. Could we do that? Could we build something like theirs? And then they build Apple Music, and Spotify still has to pay a 30% fee to Apple every time somebody signs up for Spotify's music service. But Apple Music doesn't have to pay a 30% fee to Apple because it is Apple. And so it gets this home field advantage. We see that with Amazon's private label products. We see it with Google increasingly answering search questions itself rather than sending you to outside links. So those are really, I think, at the core of the antitrust concerns that these hearings are supposed to be about.
Yeah, and I'm curious, you know, now that you've watched the actual event take place, you've seen the hearing, do you feel like there was enough coverage and questions being asked about power, as opposed to it going back to just being about the question of free speech?
It was really interesting to watch it play out, especially if you're following along on social media and seeing what people were saying about it. If you expected this hearing to be the be-all and end-all of this process, you would have been understandably disappointed. I mean, it did not. They testified for, what was it, 4 hours, 5 hours longer, and we did not get any closer to having a substantive plan for what antitrust regulation of platforms should look like, if it should look indeed any different than it does today. But that wasn't the point. And if you step back and think of this as the sixth hearing in this larger investigation, which, by the way, is supposed to culminate in a bipartisan report to Congress toward the end of this year, I think we did get a lot of important stuff out of here. I mean, there was sort of a sideshow where some of the Republican members of the subcommittee, their biggest concern is still whether Facebook and other social media platforms are biased against conservatives in their content decisions. And so they were harping on that. And that, you know, it's a good thing to sort of for them to thump the table about and get people stirred up about. It's kind of peripheral to the antitrust considerations I'm talking about. Again, not to entirely dismiss it, because the size does matter and these content moderation decisions do matter. But if you looked at what a lot of the Democratic members were asking, and a few of the Republican members, actually, the representative from North Dakota was really on point. They were drilling down into these questions of unfair competition, and they were prepared to do so because they've had five hearings leading up to this one. A lot of those hearings featured experts from academia, but also startups, the CEOs of startups in the tech industry who have been wronged, who have felt themselves on the wrong side of this competition with the platforms that are supposed to be hosting them, that are supposed to be their business partners. So they asked really tough questions. They came with receipts. They got some interesting admissions, or at least some sort of non-denials out of the CEOs. I think there's a lot to go on as they continue this bigger process of the investigation leading up to the report.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's been really interesting to me this time around, like you say, that we've been here before, and I feel like we always end up at the end of one of these hearings kind of going, okay, well, that was a little bit of a waste of time. You know, they got to kind of like wag their finger at the CEOs that are sitting in the hot seat. But this time around, what I'm hearing, what we're all hearing a lot about are these receipts that you mentioned. I mean, we're talking, you know, the House Antitrust Subcommittee released a huge amount of documents. And they seem to be pointing to a lot of very interesting things. You know, we've heard a little bit about the Amazon, you know, the deal that Apple was willing to make to Amazon in order to get their video content on the platform and to cut them a deal, even though Apple, you know, says it treats all developers fairly, and a whole bunch of other things. Like, what stands out to you as far as those documents that were released? Like, are there any highlights that you think are like, okay, this is pretty damning?
I thought the most compelling moment of the hearing was when Representative Jayapal from Washington was questioning Mark Zuckerberg about Facebook's acquisition of Instagram in 2012. Now, as one of the Republican members pointed out, that acquisition did clear antitrust scrutiny at the time, and I think understandably so, because Facebook back in 2012, it was big, it was dominant. But there was a prevailing line of thinking that the next Facebook would come along and do to them what they had just done to MySpace a few years earlier, knock them off their perch. So their dominance was not as solidified as it is today. Instagram had basically no, you know, very little revenue at the time, only a dozen or a couple dozen employees. So I think it makes sense that it cleared antitrust scrutiny at the time. But as we look back on it, the deal looks very different. And Representative Jayapal came with transcripts from chats, from things that the Instagram founder, Kevin Systrom, had said at the time, stuff that Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook executives had said at the time about the acquisition. And it became clear from those documents that Facebook absolutely looked at this as a way to maintain its stranglehold. They absolutely looked at it as taking out a competitor, which is something that Facebook had earlier denied. They denied that Instagram was a rival. These documents showed that they did regard Instagram as a rival. There were documents that showed that Instagram's founder and the founders of other companies approached by Facebook for acquisition felt pressured by Facebook. They felt threatened that if we don't sell to Facebook, Facebook will copy our product, drive us out of business. And so I think that was a point that was established specifically in this hearing that's noteworthy. One other that I think was noteworthy was the questioning of Amazon about whether it uses its privileged data on third-party sales on its platform to decide which sectors to jump into, which of those third-party sellers it wants to compete with, and where it can beat them, where it can build something that's an Amazon Basics product or a private label product that will make a lot of money and maybe even knock those competitors out of the way or out of business. Amazon's Jeff Bezos was not able to unequivocally deny that Amazon has done that, which is especially noteworthy because a year ago in one of these earlier hearings, an Amazon representative had said under oath to Congress that they don't do that. And then the Wall Street Journal had a great report earlier this year talking to ex-employees who said, we did do that. We did that all the time. And Bezos was unable to give a satisfactory response to that.
The other thing that I think is worth touching on, you know, we saw earlier, and I think this might still be a little bit inside the bubble, but there was a huge conversation and a bit of a blowout after an email application, a new way to do email called Hey, was denied access to update its app on the App Store due to it not following the App Store guidelines that Apple had set forth. And there was a conversation about how the company didn't want to pay the huge percentage, huge in quotes there, the percentage to do the payment plan through Apple's own platform. And, you know, with that came this conversation about antitrust and kind of bringing that up again. And I know that Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, touched on the App Store guidelines and the percentage and how it could have been more or less. Do you think that Apple and Tim Cook did a good job of kind of explaining that this situation was not antitrust, or do you feel that you know, there's still more to be gleaned from that? I'm curious, kind of your take on the response that Apple has had about its antitrust concerns, specifically related to its App Store, the money that it makes off of the App Store.
That's a great question, and I think it's worth here again making the distinction between what we actually saw in this hearing and what might come out of the larger process. I did think that the questioning of Tim Cook about Apple's App Store policies was not as sharp as some of the questioning about Facebook's Instagram acquisition or Amazon's use of data to decide which third-party sellers to compete with. I thought that was unfortunate. There seemed to be a couple of misunderstandings among the representatives who were asking those questions. And again, I think a lot of the representatives came very prepared and were well-informed, but there were just a couple of missteps there. I think Apple fared pretty well. I thought Tim Cook fared fairly well in the hearing in being able to fend off those questions. I do not know if he will fare as well when the bipartisan report comes out, assuming it does, and assuming they're able to reach any kind of common ground between the two parties, given how different concerns are about these companies, because there was another hearing where one company after the next, including David Heinemeier Hansen, who's the CTO of Basecamp, which makes that email program, testified to these same subcommittee members and explained the whole thing in depth. So they have all that in their files. I don't think they got anything damning from Cook in this hearing, but I think the case is real. I mean, the app was denied according to this policy that says you can't have an app in the iOS App Store that that doesn't work without being able to sign up through Apple and giving Apple that 30% commission. Apple eventually backed down from that to some extent, and Hayes app is now in the App Store. And I think that shows that this process has positive effects, even apart from whatever, you know, legislation or changes in enforcement it could lead to down the road. It's already applying pressure on these companies to change how they do business so that they can avoid sort of the most egregious things that are likely to result in tougher regulation.
Well, Will Arimus, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. If folks want to follow you online and see the great work that you're doing, where do they go to do that?
Go to 10.medium.com. So 10 is the new tech and science publication from Medium. You can also follow me on Twitter at Will Arimus.
Awesome. Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I'll talk to you soon. All right, China has plans for the internet, and they don't actually involve the internet as we know it. That's going to come up next here. We'll talk with Stephen Shanklin from CNET about that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Monday.com, a team management platform that actually lets teams plan, manage, and track work in one centralized place, which is perfect for where we're all working right now, spread out all across the place. So you can collaborate with your teammates and track everything your team is working on wherever you happen to be in any industry, whether you work with a team of 5 or 5,000. Monday.com is the easiest way to keep everyone connected and on track. So many of your employees are working from home right now. Monday.com is a project management platform that actually makes effective teamwork possible anywhere. So you can keep your team's work in one place. You just bring all your team together wherever you happen to be so you can plan, track, and manage your business as usual in one single easy-to-use platform. You can improve coordination across teams and departments. So, you know, that means easily tracking and managing their work so your team always knows what's being done and by who and when. You can keep everyone connected under a single source of truth. Also, centralized communication, so you won't need check-in meetings, which who enjoys those? But remote-ready templates, so you can get your entire team up to speed seamlessly. You can map out everything visually. I'm definitely a visual learner. It works well for me. So however you choose to run your projects, such as Gantt chart, timeline, Kanban, or spreadsheet-like tables, Monday.com has you covered. The platform is totally customizable. It adapts to your needs. Monday.com actually increases your productivity and efficiency while facilitating transparency to improve collaboration. No code automations that actually let you put your team's workflow on autopilot. So you get alerts, automatic status updates, project flows that'll all keep your team on track and confident in their work. And you can integrate your team's go-to tools and connect their existing tools to get more work done. Their integrations are super powerful. Zoom, Slack, email, calendar, spreadsheets, so much more. Definitely take a look. Make data-driven decisions by tracking progress, timelines, and budgets. You can make key decisions based on real-time data rather than guests. I know here at Twit, you know, managing all of these different projects or podcasts that we do, they're all their own individual projects with different people to book and different information to proliferate and different workers to assign to testing Skype. And all these things can be easily managed through monday.com. It just that's what it's all about. That's why it exists. So join over 100,000 teams already getting things done with monday.com. They even have onboarding specialists upon request to help you get the most out of their platform. It's so valuable. Change the way you work online. Let monday.com take care of what slows you down and free up time to focus on the work that drives you. To start your free 14-day trial, go to monday.com/twit. That's monday.com/twit. And we thank monday.com for their support. All right. So when we're talking about, you know, yesterday's hearing, there's something that kind of came up at a couple of different points throughout the hearing. And I don't know, I just hadn't like drawn the connections between the two things, but this talk about China's kind of new approach to the internet. And it turns out that our guest Stephen Shanklin from CNET wrote about this this internet a couple of weeks ago. So I reached out to Stephen, and Stephen joins us now. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, it's good to see you again. It's been too long. Yeah. So first, let's talk a little bit about how China's new IP plan, as it's called, how that plan kind of surfaced, like, and in what context to yesterday's hearings?
Sure. Well, China has a lot of ideas for how it thinks the internet should work. And those came up yesterday in Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's testimony. So obviously, Facebook is under a lot of pressure right now for not controlling its platform enough so that it's the manipulations, disinformation, lies, all kinds of stuff that people think is bad for society happening on Facebook right now. So to kind of reverse, to give Congress a different idea, Zuckerberg raised this boogeyman of China. Well, he's basically saying, you think all this free speech has got a downside? Well, look what's happening in China right now. Free speech and innovation is a lot harder there. So you might want to control things better on Facebook, sure, but you don't want to go the direction China is. So he was sort of raising this as an alternative bad guy to make Facebook look better.
Okay. All right. And definitely, you know, now is the time for that message to be very potent. There's been a lot of pushback on the kind of China influence and technology, especially here in the U.S., which we'll talk about. But what is this new IP plan? This is at great length what you wrote about a few weeks ago. And it was just kind of the first time that I was like, okay, new IP. I hadn't heard that term. But what is the idea here? This is not necessarily internet as we know it. It's a new kind of internet. It actually, as I'm speaking out loud, it reminds me of the Silicon Valley kind of plot theme where they were going to create a new internet. It's exactly that, except different because it's in China, and China is, as you say, the boogeyman. So what is new IP?
Yeah, well, IP stands for Internet Protocol, and it's one of the key standards that makes the whole internet work. It's been around since the get-go, decades ago. New IP, it's just a label. It's not like an official brand name or an official technology. Right now, all it is a proposal. So we don't actually have working specifications. We don't have network equipment that supports it. We don't have algorithms that figure out how to route data from one system to another. It's ideas at this stage. It's got a lot of shiny whistles, lots of fun things to it. So the companies that are backing it, some of them state-owned, and Huawei, which is obviously intense political scrutiny right now in the West. The outfits who are backing this, they see problems with today's internet, and they want to fix some of those problems. And the approach they're taking is they're saying, well, we need a new internet technology plumbing that will allow a lot of cool features. So they raise some interesting examples like holographic communication, which is what we're doing right now, but instead of a video feed, you get a full fidelity three-dimensional hologram. Sounds cool. Another one is remote driving. So you have delays in the network are low enough that you'd be able to control something far away with, you know, very little lag. So that's useful for remote driving or telemedicine. Another idea is linking lots of separate networks like satellite internet to our regular internet. So, you know, for example, Elon Musk's Starlink satellites orbiting right now, maybe those would get along better with today's internet. And then another big piece is better security. So you would be able to attribute the source of an attack over the internet, like a denial of service attack where you flood a server with a whole lot of traffic and you take it offline. That would be easier to block. So there are some nice ideas in there for sure. And those ideas are really leading the sales pitch for the new IP plan. It first emerged very quietly last year in a United Nations agency called the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union. This is a government controlled, government run agency because it's the United Nations. And it's very different from how the internet is developed today. And this has been bubbling for several months now, and it's now much higher profile because there's another big ITU meeting coming this November. It's one of their four-year meetings, and that's where these Chinese players really want to get the new IP plan to stick, to get a whole lot of support for it, chiefly by governments.
So as you're talking about kind of the things that it promises, I'm trying to like look at the internet that we have and understand why those things aren't possible as is now. And I also fully realize like there's a flip side to this. Of course, it gives governments way more control and way more power over the internet. Right now, there isn't a whole lot of control that can be gained. This new plan would give that control. So that obviously there's that benefit, especially for a government like the one in China. But is the current internet, like for the upsides that you listed there, capable of these things already?
Yes and no. So if you want to, you know, have terabytes of bits per second transferred enough to support real-time holographic communication, no, it's not up to that. That's just way too much network capacity than we have today. But you have to realize also today's internet is not yesterday's internet or the internet that was invented a few decades ago. It's a constant work in progress. And in fact, the loose affiliation of standards groups that develops the internet is already working on every single one of these technologies, lowering latency, improving data transfer capacity, improving security. A lot of those things are not radical, shocking new ideas. Why didn't I think of that? No, that's exactly what they're thinking of. So whether they can get it done or not is another question. But you have to compare today's internet to the one that existed before. I mean, right now we're having a real-time conversation over video stream. That was utterly unthinkable on the internet I first started off on, which was just about up to, you know, sending email. So it's really profoundly transformed. And the exact multi-stakeholder model, it's called, that developed today's internet is working on tomorrow's internet as well.
Yeah, to a certain degree, it kind of feels like a little bit of a Trojan horse, like, look at all these great things. And by the way, there's these things that you wouldn't necessarily find great, potentially, depending on who you are, what country you are, whatever, the fact that we have full control over everything. And that's the real reason why we want to create this. It seems to feel that way anyways. Now, you write that it would be incompatible with the current internet. Would there be any sort of kind of collaborative relationship between these two technologies, or completely off on its own island?
That's not exactly clear. In order to build this new IP internet, you would have to completely change all the existing technology, hardware and software, for routing data from one place to another. So you would have to really significantly rebuild the internet. And that would be incompatible with today's internet. And that's one of the biggest practical problems new IP has. You could build bridges between the new IP internet and today's internet. And so in principle, data could transfer from one side to the other. But that adds a lot of expense. And unless you can convince people to completely move away from the old internet, then you just end up running two internets. And that's really expensive, really complicated, and a very practically difficult problem that new IP faces.
Yeah. Now, if you end up in a scenario where, you know, some of the big tech companies like Facebook, although Zuckerberg kind of made his point known as far as how he feels about this idea, if they were to suddenly back it to some degree, that could actually, you know, that could actually sway things a little bit and create the support or the interest needed in order to do this. Has there been any interest that we know of outside of some of these companies and forces inside of China to say, hey, well, actually, we could get behind this, even if there's, you know, stipulations around that to say we could get behind this if this and if not that? Like, has there been any interest?
In short, no. The current people who develop the internet are often employees at these tech giants, Google, mm-hmm. Facebook, Cisco. Those are the kinds of people who have a lot of expertise in understanding how the existing internet works. And the interesting thing here is that these companies, these big companies like Microsoft with Azure, Amazon with Amazon Web Services, Google with Google Cloud, and all the websites they operate and all the services online they operate, all the internet infrastructure they operate, in effect, all these companies have veto power over what comes out of some United Nations agency. So it could be in principle that the United Nations will step up and say, this is an opportunity for us to have a much bigger say on this very important technology. But all these companies, if they don't like it, they just won't bother with it. And so that is, you know, that's the gap between one organization creating a standard and then the ground truth of how technology actually works in the real world. So there is really very little support that I detected in the technology world. Now, that's a very U.S.-centric technology world. The internet was invented in the United States, and a lot of United States-based companies dominate it. And so that could change in the future, of course. But right now, I really didn't detect any enthusiasm for new IP out there in the real existing technology landscape we have today.
Yeah, it does make me wonder, because I hadn't really spent much time considering this before. I mean, you mentioned just a few minutes ago, I mean, the internet is constantly evolving. What it was 20 years ago is, you know, so different from where we are now. Have to imagine 20 years from now, things are going to, you know, be exponentially even more different. But at the same time, like, it does beg the question, like, at some point, this thing that we invented 20, 30 plus years ago, will it hit a point to where it just makes more sense to create a new version of this altogether based on what needs we have wherever we are down the line when we decide to do that? Or does it, you know, constantly, continually evolve? And what does that look like? I mean, obviously, I know that you don't have the ability to look into the future. But what do you feel like if you look at this and, you know, from your heart space, like, do you kind of feel like at a certain point the internet just needs to be revamped in some way, or is it good enough to stand the test of time?
That's not clear to me. I do think the internet has proved remarkably resilient, and the foundation that was laid decades ago, those two key protocols, TCP/IP, Transmission Control Protocol, and Internet Protocol, which govern pretty much how most of the data is sent these days on the internet, perhaps not most because there's another one in there that's widely used for video. But, you know, that foundation has been incredibly robust, and there are very smart people working on improving it. I don't know if at some point it runs out of steam and you have to tear things up and start completely from scratch. But I will say that they are working on some pretty difficult problems, and already some of the ones new IP hopes to address included on that list. And there are a lot of some of those shiny bells and whistles that the new IP folks are trying to hold out as a reason to adopt it. For example, really low delay communications, good for remote piloting of an aircraft or a car, good for telemedicine so you can do surgery across the continent. There are fundamental physical limits and there are fundamental technology issues in actually implementing that kind of those kinds of benefits that maybe our current internet won't be able to support those, but it's not clear to me that the new IP actually would be able to either. Right now, it's just an idea. It's at the idea phase, not the working technology phase. So we might run out of steam with the current internet, but it's proven remarkably resilient, and it's very hard to change. We've seen many times in the technology world the tremendous advantage an incumbent technology has, in part because a lot of existing vested players spend a lot of time and energy improving it, and that's where we are with the internet today.
Yeah, right on. Stephen Shanklin, of course, writes for CNET.com. Stephen, it's always great to get you on. It's been too long. I appreciate your time, and we'll be sure to reach out and have you back again soon. Appreciate it.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, man. Take care of yourself. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. And coming up, a promising and, frankly, incredibly fascinating look at artificial intelligence. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Salesforce Service Cloud. Salesforce Service Cloud wants you to be prepared during these unknown times. They understand that you're trying to do more with less resources, hustling to adapt to new customer needs, and innovating your business to respond to the current environment. You want satisfied customers, which means you need a platform that performs quickly and efficiently to meet their needs. Service Cloud is the world's number one customer service platform, empowering organizations to deliver service from anywhere at any time. From out of the box to fully customizable support, find the best solution for your customers. Service Cloud allows you to rapidly respond to customer needs on any channel, chat, SMS, WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, and more, from home, in the field, or at the office. Provide instant support with self-service portals. Connect customers to articles, account info, and community members to find answers instantly. Work smarter with built-in AI. Embed AI-powered chatbots to help resolve customer issues quickly. Give your service team the tools to provide an unforgettable customer experience. Resolve cases faster while using the suite of intelligent productivity tools, giving agents a complete shared view of every customer and interaction. Utilize the capability of personalizing every customer conversation and allow them to always respond with the right level of service. It's built on a fast, flexible platform, so Salesforce Service Cloud enables trailblazers to provide world-class service anytime, anywhere, whether it's messaging or chat or phone or self-service or in person. Over 150,000 companies keep their customers happy with Salesforce. Provide your customer service agents with a fast and flexible service platform that keeps them and your customers happy. Go to bit.ly/Salesforce for service to find out how the world's number one service platform can help you grow your business. That's bit.ly/Salesforce for service. Thanks so much to Salesforce for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. All right, I was absolutely impressed and kind of blown away by the latest OpenAI artificial intelligence model. It's called GPT-3. So this is the third iteration of this tool. There's a lot to this, obviously. Anytime you talk about artificial intelligence, it gets pretty into the weeds pretty quickly. But I think that one of the best ways that those of us who are not AI scientists and machine learning scientists can kind of understand what we're working with is through examples. And because of the way that OpenAI has set up the GPT-3 technology, there are dozens of examples that show how GPT-3 works. There is an article from The Verge, from James Vincent over at The Verge, who that quickly describes GPT-3 as the ultimate autocomplete. And that's because this is a text-based artificial intelligence model that lets you type in some sort of query, something that you want, and then it spits out an answer to you. and you can give it information to help it understand what your, you know, what kind of your database is, what it is that you're going to be talking about. And then it can spit out answers based on that thing. But just thinking of that, it's kind of like, oh, okay, so I'm just talking to a computer and it's giving me some numbers when I say 2 + 2 = 4. No. This thing is next level. This thing is absolutely wild. And so it starts with something like, you know, in Google, it's funny, to this day, my partner still, when he does a Google search, I can hear, because sometimes he'll say it out loud. And so he'll be typing in, blah, 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 blah. And it's a question. So I don't know, how on average, how many seed pods are on a dying dandelion? But he would type that whole thing in. Whereas I would type in average seed pods dandelion, and that would be it. Mm-hmm. He'll type out the whole question. Well, this search engine can answer that question using GPT-3 and give you that information in an easy to understand answer. So, John, if you want to pop open, there's a tweet from Paras Chopra that talks about a search engine that they built on this technology. And so the video shows you and says, ask me anything. And basically, just from an arbitrary query that they've typed in this case, it's, let's see, it's kind of hard to see because it's a little bit blurry at first because of Twitter. How many carbon atoms are there in
benzene?
Thank you. I couldn't see that from here. And it immediately takes that information and tells you there are 6 carbon atoms and 6 other atoms in this, and then goes on to just ask some other questions. And not only does it give you a simple one sentence answer, which search engine actually does that properly, yeah, right, when I ask a question, but then takes it and gives you a link to that information. That's just one example of this. John, can you scroll down to the part where it shows autocomplete of images? This is bonkers. This is wild. So there's in the Verge article, there it shows autocomplete images, not just text. And on the far left of the page, you'll see some icons, and it's just like half of an image. So there's half of a cat, half of, I can't even tell what that first thing is, half of a crowd, and then half of a water droplet. And then GPT-2 takes that information and makes a bunch of autocomplete options for you. And at the far right is the original image. So with just that information, you can see all of these different options that actually, some of those cat ones especially are hilarious, and I'm more interested in than the one that it actually, you know, than the actual original image.
The cat ones are so great. I love them. They're so memeable.
For you, Jason, the guitar tab generator. So Amanda Askell has used GPT-3. It says guitar tabs are shared on the web using ASCII or ASCII text files. Mm-hmm. So you can bet they compromise part of GPT-3's training data set. Naturally, that means GPT-3 can generate music itself after being given a few chords to start. So you in ASCII give it a few chords, and then it'll write a song, for God's sake.
Yeah, love it.
You know, these are just tabs, so it's not, you know, a full-on song, but it's doing that. And then there's one where it answers medical queries. So a medical student tried to kind of trick it by asking it. This is how it's sort of put out. So it says, the question that they typed in: a 10-year-old boy presents with recurrent episodes of dyspnoia. I have no idea what that means. Cough and wheeze triggered by cold air and allergens. After performing tests, he is diagnosed with an obstructive disease and given medication. Which receptor is the medication most likely to work on? Let's break this down for a second. I'm not going to break down the actual medical question, but I'm going to break down how difficult this would be for a machine to understand. Because not only are you asking this question in a very human way, where you've got, you know, this thing, comma, and then the definition of that thing, but then you're saying after performing tests, he is diagnosed with an obstructive disease and given medication. So you say he's given medication. Then in the next one, you say which receptor is the medication most likely to work on. a normal, you know, computer program trying to tackle that problem would need to understand context to say when the human is saying the medication, they're talking about the medication they just referred to. And that means that they're talking about this diagnosis of the 10-year-old boy. You have to understand the full context of that question. And most of the systems that we have in place right now simply cannot do that. It's so funny how Siri and the Google Assistant and Alexa, one of the headline features every year is like, it understands context a little bit more. So you can say, turn on the light in the living room, and then you should be able to say, what color is the light set to? The light, referring to the question you just asked. But most of those assistants cannot answer that question. So this not only understands the way that the sentence is structured, but then goes on to answer the question. And what the medical student says is that this is purposefully a really difficult question. You could make an argument for some of the other answers, but B is the single best answer based on the information given. So the AI answered the question and then provided an explanation for its answer to the question. This is mind-blowing. This is incredible. Yeah. This is next level. And these are only some of the examples that have been given. There's a whole website where one of the folks have taken this OpenAI GPT-3 and created creative fiction from it. So there's a Tom Swifty, I had never heard of this, and I feel kind of bad not knowing this, but essentially it's a self-describing sentence pun. So you can create Tom Swifties. So they fed the GPT-3 some Tom Swifties that were written by Scott Alexander, this person, to prompt it. And then after that, it takes that information and then creates its own. So I was certainly unlucky enough to lose all my cards, Tom said slyly. Being a hoarder is something people are born with, Tom said hereditarily. The ref's call was a bad one, Tom griped. It was such a bad breakup that I got a bad ankle injury, Tom bemoaned. So breakup and getting your ankle hurt from that. The text is so small, Tom said squintingly. So you have to kind of understand what a Tom Swifty is. But in order to understand that, it comes to understand what a Tom Swifty is and then proceeds to write a bunch of Tom Swifties. It can do puns. It can do, you can give it a pun and then it will explain why it is a pun, which of course is kind of like anti-humor, but for the point of
let me tell you why it's funny.
Yeah. I'm blown away by this technology.
I love this stuff. Like I'm continually fascinated by kind of what's happening in AI and specifically AI and kind of human creativity and these worlds kind of blending together. We think of our brain as a incredibly complex computer and it's all logic based and you know, it's just how we live. So a lot, you know, I think most of us probably take it for granted as far as that's concerned. But now we're getting to the point to where with systems like this, these computers can think in ways that are very, I'm not saying that they're thinking exactly like a brain does, but they're thinking in ways that are very convincingly close mm-hmm. in many ways to how a human brain does. And therefore you end up crossing that line into the path of, well, I don't know if a computer wrote this or if a human wrote this. And, you know, we're seeing this in writing of, like you said, like stories, fiction, news stories that's being dynamically created around facts that are listed, and it can just create a full page news story that reads just like a story that some, you know, editor somewhere wrote, but it's a computer and just going off of, you know, these rules that are hidden within there. I love it, and I love analyzing the kind of aspects of what is creativity, like the outcome of creativity. If a human can create something and in the end another human can listen to it or see it and see art or hear art and be like, I really like the sound of that, that's beautiful, you did a great job. If a computer does that, do we think of it the same way? You know, do we think of this music that a computer created, once we get to a point where it's convincing enough that we can't tell whether a computer created it or a human created it. And that's because it's based on all these rules that humans have been following for you know, years and years. Like, when we get to that point, how will we feel about that music? Will we be accepting to the fact that, hey, you know what? This wasn't created by a human, but it's still an amazing song and I can't stop listening to it. You know, it's just, I love it. It's such a mind-bending place that we're at right now with this technology. And this is just, it just keeps getting more and more interesting, in my opinion.
I have one last example before we move on, because I think this one is amazing too. So think about the way that that there are different styles of writing. And when I say to another human, you know, I'm giving you this sentence and it's something that I would say to my friend, but I want you to take this sentence and make it something that I would say if I was a witness in a trial, or that I would say as I was going into a job interview. And a human can take that and understand what you mean from it, but for a computer to do that is a whole different thing. And so this example, they used GPT-3, they gave it plain language and they said, write this like an attorney would. So the sentence was, my landlord didn't maintain the property. And GPT-3 took that sentence, my landlord didn't maintain the property, and turned it into, the defendants have permitted the real property to fall into disrepair and have failed to comply with state and local health and safety codes and regulations. That is bizarre and amazing. Just it really is. Stuff. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and another example that I really like is the text-based adventures. You know, like when I was a kid, I used to love playing text-based adventures. Zork was just one of my favorite games when I was younger. And, you know, now you've got a computer that's like literally creating it as you go, and suddenly there's a new character. And it's just the depth in which this algorithm has created this character as you ask it questions. I mean, it's fully believable. You're like, okay, someone definitely wrote this, but no, you know, like a computer algorithm just kind of came up with it based on the information it was fed. It's just unbelievable. It's really remarkable. I wish I understood more about this stuff other than
Me too.
because where I'm at with it. I'm just constantly like in a wow space, and underneath the hood, it's actually really complicated.
There should be a podcast called In a Wow Space, where you just talk about things that are exciting and just bizarre and outside of your understanding. Copyright Jason, trademark Jason Howell. But can't spit out words because I'm so excited. I feel the same way, because OpenAI actually makes the API available for people to access and use. So I wish that I understood how this worked, because then I could use it to do fun stuff. But instead, I just kind of have to watch and see what people make, or tweet annoyingly at these different data scientists and say, can you see if it will do this? Because I can't myself. So I don't know. Maybe it will encourage me to learn more so that I can exit the wow space and enter the now space.
Yes. I like it. Oh man. Good stuff. All right. Coming up, a slice of my own computing childhood in a single app. This is really cool. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be difficult, and if it was ever difficult before, it's definitely difficult now. Everything's difficult right now. If you're a company that's currently trying to hire, you face new challenges. HousingWire could relate to that for sure. They needed to hire an ambitious reporter to cover news stories on the housing market here in the U.S., so they turned to ZipRecruiter, and that is how HousingWire found Alexandra Roja. Alexandra never imagined that she could get a reporter job, especially during COVID-19. So she created a profile on ZipRecruiter, and ZipRecruiter matched Alexandra to HousingWire's reporter job because her degree and her writing skills were a great fit for the role. And that's exactly how ZipRecruiter works. It finds the right qualified people and invites them to apply for your position. HousingWire received her application only 4 hours after they posted the job. And a few weeks later, Alexandra started her dream career. So pretty sweet stuff. My wife has used ZipRecruiter for her business. So many people have used it. We've used it at Twit, of course. It's just really effective way for finding qualified candidates. So you should check it out. Let ZipRecruiter help you hire, and see why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Try it now for free at ZipRecruiter.com/TNW. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNW. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire, and we thank them for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right, so my story of the week, it's not quite as intricate and detailed as the AI story we just talked about, but I just think this is neat. And actually, in some ways, it's kind of similar in the sense that technology has advanced so far that we are, yes, in a place where AI systems are creating things that are hard to distinguish between, you know, made by computer and made by human. We're also in a place where we can take legacy operating systems and make them a single-click app that, that you can just open like any app on your computer. So Mac OS 8 is now an application, and you can download it for Mac or PC. And it's just like in my applications folder, there's my Mac OS 8. Felix Reisberg, who's a Slack developer, made the app. He turned a Macintosh Quadra 9000 running Mac OS 8.1 into an Electron app. So it's fully emulated. It's running entirely in JavaScript. The app itself is only 185 megs. And he even included some games with it. It comes with Duke Nukem 3D, Civilization 2, Dungeons & Dragons, and a few others. You also get a bunch of Adobe trial apps, so you can check out Photoshop 3, Premiere 4, and a few other things.
Wow.
Internet Explorer and Netscape are pre-installed. Unfortunately, though, it doesn't connect to the internet, so you can't you can't like browse the internet through.
Wait,
those
it doesn't
old
take me back to Web 2.0.
No, it's not going to take.
I guess
you
that's
there.
Even before Web 2.0, huh?
Yes, yeah, totally. This is like 91, maybe. I'm thinking.
Oh, I'm getting this for sure.
Oregon Trail. Back when I was in high school, I had a Macintosh SE30. So it was similar time to this. I don't know if it was OS 8.1 or not, but you know, my Mac was it was a black and white display. I used it with primarily I got it because of Adobe PageMaker. I was publishing some fanzines at the time. And so I used it to do desktop publishing, which was awesome. I thought I was so lucky because I could lay it out on my screen and everything. and I also used it to play many, many hours of Shuffle Puck Cafe, which was a really great game.
Shuffle Puck Cafe.
Yeah, it's, you know, shuffle, what is it? Air hockey, essentially, is what it is.
Oh, gotcha.
But, oh, man, but it was so magical because before that I had a Commodore 64 and I never had a mouse for my Commodore 64. It just wasn't a computer that largely you used a mouse on. But so this was my first computer with a mouse, and using the mouse to move the air hockey, you know, to control the air hockey game was otherworldly for me. Anyways, so this is totally just a walk down memory lane for me to launch that app and be like, oh yeah, I remember this. This is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. I have downloaded it and will definitely be trying this out today so I can get dysentery for sure.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Oregon Trail's on there as well. I played that a little last night. Just kind of a neat light story of the week, but I love that people do this. And just the fact that it's like an entire operating system residing as a single
That's
app in
wild.
My applications folder. It's just cool that we can do this now. I want all old computer operating systems as a single app, you know, and just have a folder.
Yeah.
Which is like operating systems, you know.
Windows 98. Can I please get that on the Mac as an Electron app?
It's gonna go happen.
Ahead. I can remember back in the day. I can remember when I had installed Windows Vista. No, not even that. It was Windows XP on a Windows machine that was running Windows 98. And it was not powerful enough in the end to even run Windows XP. Ugh. And I upgraded it from Windows XP to Windows Vista. And it was obviously especially not powerful enough to run Windows Vista. Yeah. And so I rolled it all the way back to Windows 98, and it was beautiful and it worked perfectly. And so, yeah, it would be nice to take it back to the days of Windows 98 and doing that on my Mac in this window that's just like breezing along, no problem. Although if it's an Electron app, it's going to be trying to take up a bunch of my CPU, as Electron apps seem to do. But that would be a lot of fun. So get on it, developers.
Yeah. Love it. I'm sure it's going to happen. Cool stuff. Definitely check it out. There's the Verge article on that where you can link right to it. But that is it. We've hit the end of this show. We've told you all the news that there is to tell you about, and we hope you've enjoyed it. Tech News Weekly publishes every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. That's where you can go to subscribe to the show. Please subscribe. If you subscribe there or even on YouTube, we're there as well. But subscribe, then you don't have to worry about it. We'll just come magically to your ears and your eyes every time there's a new episode.
Yeah, and you can follow us on social media. It's at Twit on Twitter, at twit.tv on Instagram, at Twit Talk on TikTok. I am at Micah Sargent on pretty much all of the social media networks. And check out Hands on iOS. The next episode publishes later today, and it's all about managing your group chats. If you are getting sick of all of those notifications from your group chat, I show you how you can temporarily kind of silence them, how to leave a group chat, add new people to your group chat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What about you, Jason?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Jason Howell, and my Android show, Hands on Android, just published a new episode. Thank you, John, for putting that up today. It is taking screenshots when Android won't let you. There are certain apps on your phone where you're not allowed to take a screenshot or shoot video or whatever. And so I kind of walk through why that is and kind of show you a few ways that maybe you can work around it, because there are ways to work around it. And maybe you have a good reason to. Don't do it for bad things. Do it for good things. But there you go. twit.tv/HOA. And that is it. Thanks to John and Burke for helping us do this show each and every week. And thanks to you for watching and listening. We'll see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Be sure to check out the other shows on the network, like my other show, Hands On Wellness. I love to share different tips and tricks that's going to help you get a better grasp on your personal wellness. Just go to twit.tv/how and subscribe now.